Hello, welcome to CKUT. You're listening to STEMinism. It is currently Friday, March 15th, 5:03 p.m. We're very excited to have you listening to our show today, and we're very excited to be here. Really quickly, I wanted to kick off our show by talking about CKUT's funding drive this week and next week. So us gals here at STEMinism have pledged to make personalized playlists for any listeners who donate $20 or more during the duration of our hour today. And I will also bake you a lemon pound cake for the first person who donates $40 during our hour. If you don't like lemon pound cake, let me know. I'll make you something else. I can make it vegan. I can make it gluten-free, whatever you want. But yeah, very happy to be part of the station. We're very lucky to have our show here, so Funding Week is something that's really important to us. CKUT has been broadcasting the sounds of Montreal since 1987, and for decades, programmers, including you, have cooked up all kinds of musical blends, news, and views from all across the city, and so much more to expand listeners' tastes, views, and blow their minds. You can't hear programming like this anywhere else. CKUT really does nurture a special blend of radio that's very unique to Montreal. We're multilingual, multicultural, always interesting radio here. So we really need you, our community, to come together to support this meaningful legacy and ensure that CKUT can continue to be the voice of our city for years to come. And the funds that you donate to CKUT will be used for a lot of different, very necessary things, including rent for the building, utilities. Rent alone costs $60,000 a year. Renting the broadcast tower, the transmitter, new equipment repairs, miscellaneous expenses like postage, turntable needles, office supplies, promotion materials, and the salaries of our 6 full-time staff, 2 part-time staff, and then all student staff, as well as events, workshops, and any fun ideas that you guys might have in the future for the station. But most importantly, the money will go towards the station's core operating costs. CKUT is facing a deficit right now, and we need to close that gap in order to ensure the station's continued existence. So with that being said, you can donate through the website at ckut.ca/donate. And there's also some incentives to donate based on how much you donate. So there'll be raffles, there'll be prizes to win. So thank you so much if you donate even a dollar. We really appreciate it. And again, if you want a lemon pound cake, go straight to ckut.ca to donate.
Yep. And we can confirm that Ali is an absolute fantastic baker, and it will be an amazing cake.
Thanks. I hope that's true.
It is very true.
So yeah, with that spiel behind us, we're really looking forward to you guys listening to STEMinism today. We have a very special guest, so Amelie, if you want to take it away.
It would be my pleasure. Today we're super excited to have Zaid Alazawi with us. He is an MD-PhD student at the MRI here in Montreal, working in Ted Fond's lab on Parkinson's disease using stem cells. I'm especially excited because he's my best friend, so yay. And apart from being an amazing researcher and future doctor, he also has an impeccable taste in music, so all the song suggestions from today are his courtesy.
Oh, and I forgot to mention, we did listen to one of Zaid's favorite songs right before we started the show, which was What Now by Brittany Howard. So yay. Definitely want to shout out that song. Wonderful song.
So yay. So happy to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you. It's off her new album, which is out. It's amazing. She was the lead singer of Alabama Shakes.
Yes.
If anybody remembers Alabama Shakes. Yeah. But they went on hiatus, but she's been doing solo work, and nice. Her latest album is like, it's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, so because we're a science-y radio thingy, let's come to the not fun part. Do you want to tell us a bit about your research and what you do on a daily basis?
Yeah, so I'll start with the research. I basically study Parkinson's disease, as mentioned earlier. I mostly look at a specific protein that's been like a hallmark of Parkinson's disease pathology, which is alpha-synuclein. And I'm trying to look at how alpha-synuclein aggregates, i.e. how it tends to clump together and basically how that leads to dysfunction in cells and cell models, as a way to try to understand how the pathology of Parkinson's disease manifests and affects patients. Day-to-day, it's crazy, so it's different each day, but it's a lot of meetings, a lot of research, and then a lot of after work hours activities. Yeah.
So what made you want to pursue specifically an MD and a PhD to look at Parkinson's? Like, was there a specific time in your life that made you really interested in it, or is just something that you kind of came across?
It's a very cool question. It's one of the first questions they ask you in the MD PhD interview. So right. You have to have that answer ready.
Do you feel like you're in the interview right now?
No, it's very chill. I'm amongst friends. It's fine. Actually give my real answer here.
Not the, the real one. Yeah. I have MMI scenarios prepared.
Awesome. So I can't wait. So I think I didn't take this path it wasn't something that I had thought about very early on. It was something that I discovered in my educational journey. So I always knew that medicine was where I wanted to go eventually. So that was I was born to be a doctor thing, kind of. It's a cliche, but yes. But when I got to, we immigrated to Canada in 2014. So when I got here, it wasn't like in the Middle East where I'm used to, where you go from high school to medical school, you have to go through an undergraduate degree. And so when I did my bachelor at the University of Toronto, that's actually when I first got into research. And at the time it was prion diseases. But that experience was really formative for me. And I discovered this passion for the craziness that is science. And so I decided then that I was I wanted more of that, really. So then I went and did a master's at the University of Toronto, and then the master's where it got confirmed to me that okay, if I'm going to pursue medicine, it has to have some science in it as well. And especially in neurodegenerative diseases research, because that's where I think that's the type of research that I gravitated to the most. And that's why we came with to the decision of the MD PhD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wait, real quick, can we go back to the prion stuff? Because I think prions are really cool, but they're also the scariest thing on the planet.
Yes.
I've heard that in lab settings, you can't kill them they're really hard to kill.
Yeah.
So what were you doing, and what was the protective personal equipment
really quickly to interject, can you explain what prions are?
Insane, crazy. No, I'm kidding. It's actually not that exciting. Okay, so prions are these proteins that have the tendency to misfold. Basically, a protein exists in a structure in nature, and that's the lowest energy structure that's favorable for it to exist for a long time. But prions have the ability to just spontaneously out of nowhere misfold, and so they adopt a different structure, but then they recruit other proteins, and so they have this ability to once they've misfolded to recruit other protein that hasn't misfolded to them and aggregate. Alpha-synuclein behaves in a prion-like way, which is why I'm studying it now in Parkinson's disease. But the interesting thing about prions is that they're the only known neurodegenerative diseases that are infectious. And so you guys might be more familiar with Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease or mad cow disease. They're not the same. But bovine spongiform encephalopathy is the scientific name for mad cow disease. And Creutzfeldt-Jakob, both of those are actually prion diseases. And both of them are, like, transmitted through, like, Creutzfeldt-Jakob, for instance, is transmitted through, brain tissue of patients that have, like, prion disease. And then mad cows through ingesting the meat of, you know, cows that have had mad cow. And so it's the only sort of neurodegenerative disease that's like, that's very zombie-like, so to speak, because like it transmits like, from person. Yeah, yeah. And so it was very cool to be like, as an undergrad when I started in the lab, to be like, oh, you're working on prions. Like, you know, that's the next like big thing. And what? But in reality, that transmission across species or across patients is very inefficient. Okay. So, like, out of the millions of people who ate tainted meat in the UK when they had the mad cow like epidemic, let's say, about 250 actually got infected.
I feel like I definitely heard it was way more than that and was like super scared of meat as a kid.
Yes. Yeah. No, the media will also always like, you know, hype it up. Yeah. But it's very inefficient. So you don't like, and out of all those patients who have had mad cow, there has never been like one where like, you know, their spouse also got it or their loved one got it. Like you really need to have exposure at almost a high level, and it needs to be in a way that it's efficient, like it will template in your body.
So how is Creutzfeldt-Jakob transmitted? Do you have to like
lick a brain?
Yeah. No. So interesting is that it was called Kuru. So it's something similar to like Creutzfeldt-Jakob, where it's like it was found or discovered in a tribe in Papua New Guinea, because they had a ritual where they would eat the brains of or cannibalize the brains of those who have recently passed as a way to honor them. But they do it like, and it's raw. And so ingesting that, a lot of those people in those tribes used to have a disease called Kuru, which is very similar to prion disease. The issue with prion disease as well is that it's a very long incubation period. So you could have it for like 20 years, 2 decades, 30, doesn't matter. But once symptoms start to manifest, it's about a year. Until literally, it's called spongiform encephalopathy because your brain looks like a sponge. Like there's all these like gaps between cells and a lot of cell death. And so patients tend to like reach mortality in a very short time.
That's kind of scary.
It is unsettling. Yeah. But the thing is that I worked in that lab, but it's like I was working on creating like a mutations in the Bankvol prion protein, which is a specific species. Bankvols are really cute if you want to look them up. But they're the only known prion protein. Like, prion protein is expressed by all of mammals, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's everywhere. It's not, like, specific to us, but every species has their own prion protein. And the Bankvol prion protein is very special because it's the only protein that allows transmission from every other species, almost. It's a universal acceptor. And actually, we just recently submitted an article about that. That I'm co-author on. So nice. About nice. Why it's a universal Shout acceptor. Out. So read that. I think it's on BioArchive right now, but yeah.
Congrats.
Thank you.
If people wanted to read that article, what should they search?
Ooh, Bankvol universal acceptor. It's by Arshad.
Probably like Google Zayd Alazawi BioArchive.
Yeah. But I'm third author on that paper, so
you're like, on there. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I'm there. We take that. But yeah, universal acceptor, prions, Bankvol.
How do you spell that?
Which part?
Bankvol.
B-A-N-K. Literally bank.
Okay. Bankvol. Yeah.
B-A-N-K and then Vol, V-O-L-E.
Nice.
Yeah. But yeah, so for me, it wasn't that scary because I was working mostly with bacteria to purify this Bankvol protein, and the protein on its own in that sequence, when it has very low like risk.
Okay.
But you definitely have to be careful. So it's like, you know, the standard PPE for me. But for graduate students, they were working with cell models with human prions and human made. Yeah. So with that, you wear extra protection. So extra gloves, sleeves and whatnot, goggles all the time. Mm-hmm. And you always work under a hood.
Mm-hmm.
And also that room was its own, like it was its own section because it's assigned as a biosafety level 3,
okay,
as opposed to the rest of the lab, which is a biosafety level 2. And most of the labs here at McGill are biosafety level 2. So.
Okay. I see. So did they have to like wear full-on like hazmat suits when they entered the room?
No. Because it's not like... like, A, you'd have to have exposure. You'd have to have the right exposure. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of like... you'd have to really be like... precarious with your technique in order for you to like, you have to basically like stab yourself with it.
I see.
Until you're like, okay, I'm in danger now of something. And even then it's like, it's pretty low because most of the species that we're working with are from a different species. They're not human.
Mm-hmm.
They're RML, I think is it's either hamster or mouse. And the other one is like, so it's hamster prions and mouse prions.
I see.
It's not
okay.
Really. Yeah. 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 They might transmit, but it's not like you're not at a very high risk. Stuff that you wear hazmat suit for is like really bad stuff, like smallpox. I don't know if Ebola counts, but it's also very like these are stuff like that
infectious.
Like any chance of exposure. Yeah. And it's out there.
Yeah.
I've had experiences where I've had to like completely change my clothes, wear a full on protective suit, and then wear like this like. I think that kind of looks like a jetpack so I can breathe in through a suit. And that's only for an animal facility, but in the UK, not in here.
What were you doing?
Just visiting the animal facility.
Okay.
I think in the UK, they are way more strict about exposure to like lab animals, even when they're wild type, like even when they don't carry anything or like aren't genetically engineered to be a certain way. But yeah, that was super intense. So I was wondering like, okay, oof, if with prion disease, it's, I was wondering if it would be that similar.
No, I thought the same thing when I first joined the lab. And then literally my PI was like, no, here's a bench, go ahead.
Just do it.
Do your right. I was like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
How do you kill, like if, I don't know, you have some media that's infected or something like that, how do you kill it?
Honestly, I don't know. I haven't dealt with it myself, so I haven't, but I know like for example for that room that it had its own like trash disposal and like there would be a specialized company that comes in every while to collect everything and like deal with it in a specific way. I think soap. Like high amounts of detergent.
Okay.
Because the whole thing about these like misfolded proteins is that they're hard to remove, but detergent like it's SDS, which is basically the basic component of soap. You add a high concentration of that, and a lot of it will get removed.
Nice.
So you're kind of protected there. So you wipe with soap, a lot of ethanol as well to like disinfect, and but it's not like. It's not super crazy.
If you denature prion, will it just refold into its conformation?
It's a good question. I actually don't know. It depends on how you're, like, probably denaturing it, to what extent.
Okay.
I think at low concentrations, you're probably not denaturing the whole thing. So the ability for that protein to still template its aggregation is okay. But if you use a very high concentration, you probably remove most of it. Like if you dissociate it to a single amino acid, it's done.
The amino acids won't join forces to scare you again.
Yeah.
It's done.
No. You never know. don't talk too loud. They'll hear you.
Zed, I think you just gave someone nightmares.
No, you have nothing to be worried about. There are other things that affect us more like... more closely. Like right now, the strikes that are happening with the like TAs and whatnot, injustices like that, that you can worry about.
Yeah. Not the prions.
Prions in a lab, that's too far away. Like, don't worry about it.
Tell that to COVID.
Right,
Hey, man, I'm not going there.
So what's the link between prion diseases and Parkinson's disease?
Okay, so like I said, it's a lot of these neurodegenerative diseases now, like Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, dementia with Lewy bodies, have a commonality in that there is some protein that aggregates. In Alzheimer's, it's A-beta and tau. In Parkinson's, it's alpha-synuclein. But all these aggregating proteins behave, we think, in a prion-like fashion. So they also aggregate and template other amyloid beta or tau or synuclein to aggregate with it. And we think that leads to a lot of the dysfunction. Parkinson's disease is a little special because we know that synuclein itself, like mutations in synuclein gene, are predispose individuals to early onset Parkinson's disease and familial Parkinson's disease. So you can have duplications in the gene and that will cause early onset Parkinson's. You can have triplications. You can even have point mutations where just one amino acid is changed. And then you also get familial Parkinson's disease. So it's transmitted within the family. But it's also one of the rare ones where it's like you also have environmental factors because there are other, like for instance, a lot of farmers that work with pesticides, pesticides have this compound called MPTP, which when exposed to at high dosages will result in mitochondrial dysfunction. And that also leads to Parkinsonian symptoms in those farmers. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely environmental and genetic factors at play with Parkinson's disease, but the synuclein protein, which is the protein that I'm studying, is prion-like in its aggregation pattern.
I see. Do you think that do we have a certain level of these aggregated proteins and then it just kind of gets worse over time?
Yeah, certainly. So, like, proteins will eventually, like, as they get older, let's consider them as like people, but like as they get older, they also need to be recycled, degraded, or like taken up. But the cells themselves, as they senesce, get worse at doing that job. And so there is a big discussion if like synuclein is the outcome or the cause or whatnot. Like there is that, is it the chicken or the egg? But it's hard to say. When you're studying things like that in research, the reason why it moves so slowly is because it's very hard to disentangle, like, when you see an effect to one specific cause. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, and especially in neurodegenerative diseases, where a lot of the patients you're dealing with are elderly, they've had a lot of comorbidities, like, you know, you don't, like, your grandma doesn't have just, like, one disease. She basically, like, there's heart conditions, there's diabetes, there's other things that also affect the viability of cells, their ability to degrade. And
And she hasn't been sitting in a box for 80 years, not like being exposed to the outside world. So you don't know at what point something could have.
Exactly. And so you can't, like, and that's why in neurodegenerative diseases right now, the biggest problem we have is that, like, you know, especially also with Parkinson's disease or other diseases that like have a long period of time where the patients are suffering through symptoms, but we can't, like, there's no way for us to slow it down or treat it. Parkinson's, you have L-DOPA, which tends to like extend the life expectancy by up to like 20 years now, which is pretty good.
But it doesn't actually like affect the symptoms.
Correct. No. It doesn't. It like it helps with the symptoms in the beginning, but some patients respond better than others. We don't know what the determinants of that are. And then the other thing is that, like, over time, you're not actually stopping the disease process. You're just sort of masking it. And in the end, you know, a lot of these patients succumb to neurodegeneration or dementia and things like that, a full-on, like, paralysis or something like that. It's because of that. It's because we don't know exactly, like, we know the damage that's happening, we know the mechanisms of some of it, but we actually don't know the cause per se, like what specific thing causes it, and also how's it manifesting over time, like is it mutating, like it does it.
So I know you like researching Parkinson's and prion diseases, but do you want to specifically work with Parkinson's patients as a doctor, like be a neurologist? Like what's that side of it for you?
So for me, I have a bit of a passion for like anatomy and surgery myself.
Oh, cool.
So probably when I go back to med school, I'd like to rotate in a lot of like the surgical specialties if I can. But honestly, for medicine, I haven't really picked.
Okay, fair.
Because it's like for research, I found my niche. Like I sort of just I like this and that's it. And I found like I've rotated in different labs and I've also looked at different research and like I'm not the clinical research. Sit behind your desk and type away at data and things like that. So that wasn't for me. But then, research in other fields, like cancer, for instance, it went up. Super interesting. But also wasn't for it because it's a lot of immunity and I struggle a little bit with some of the immunity stuff. But for medicine, whenever I've had a rotation or I've been like in a clinic setting or in a hospital, I think I just love being in a hospital.
Okay.
That's what I know for a fact. The other things I don't know.
Are you okay? I've had your brain checked out at some point.
It's the prions.
Yeah. Oh no.
Finally getting to you.
Yeah. No. No, I actually like the hospital environment. They might not be associated with the happiest of places, and they're definitely not. You don't want to end up being in the hospital. Yeah. But I think working within like healthcare teams and like in that environment, I find something very appealing and like that connects with me there. So, yeah, that's the medicine. I'm sorry, I should have provided a more straightforward answer.
I mean, it makes sense. Like that's it makes me happy that you don't know yet. Because a lot of us don't know what we want to do yet, right?
Yes.
So
yeah, and you would think that by the time you get to your PhD, people say, oh, so you have an idea of what you want to do. And I'm like...
absolutely not.
Absolutely not. I have never been more confused in my entire life. Yeah. It's hard.
My favorite question is, how long do you have left?
Oh, my God.
All of it, bro.
I hate that question. I hate that question.
I think my favorite conversations before I started the PhD was, I told one of my friends who didn't even go to university or anything, that I was doing the PhD, and he's like, oh, so... you're still studying to like figure your life out and like not settle have the freedom of doing whatever. And I'm like, bro, I'm in here for at least 5 years. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. It's actually a big chunk of your life. Like it's 5 years. MD PhD is 8 years.
Yeah.
The PhD is a little shorter, but it's also 4 years of medical school at the same time. But it's like all of these paths, albeit long, they also like, they help you with that self-discovery journey that I think a lot of us like. I think most people's perception is that you take this path because you haven't figured things out. But I think a lot of people recognize that like we take this path because like it provides you with a lot of tools that could help you figure things out. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is true. So. And it's kind of nice to figure things out within a structured way. Like, no matter what, I have to do this program, I have to do this thing. So you kind of have some semblance of structure in your life as opposed to, let's say, figuring out, just out in the world.
At the same time, I totally agree. And it's a lot of growth, too. You're always learning, doing new things, learning new techniques. So it's not like you're stagnant in one place for 5 years as you're trying to get your stuff together.
Yeah, they always push you to do more, and whenever you think you've done enough, it's like, okay, now you need to do even more, and that's kind of the gist of it, until you graduate, and then you do even more as a postdoc, and so on.
I think it also teaches you a lot of, like, resiliency and sort of, like how to play well with people, because I think, I think people think about like science as like these shut-ins that like sit in a basement and like do weird things, but it's really like but it is a lot of like it's a lot, especially nowadays. It's a lot of collaboration. It's a lot of dealing with people, and it's like it's a lot of understanding sort of on a global scale. Where do you fit in? Because a lot of our research really is funded by taxpayer money, and to justify it to taxpayers, you have to be able to explain why is it significant, where does it fit, how is it contributing usefully. So
as if the taxpayers had a choice, though.
I wonder, are there any referendums like in town halls where they're like, okay guys, so we have these two different research projects that we want to fund. Like, do they ever do any kind of surveys to the public?
A lot of the, I think in Canada, a lot of the research is mostly like scientists judging other scientists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I've also, sorry.
Yeah,
continue.
Go ahead. No.
I know for some research ethics boards, there's also lay people in there specifically because they want the perspective of everyone, not just the experts.
A lot of the big grants now also will have exactly like Emily said, like a group of lay audience that needs to read and approve it. Also, there is a lot of like built-in accountability. So all of our research projects, all of the funds, scholarships that we get that are publicly funded, you can find it all on the web. Like it's literally everywhere. Like CIHR has all of our abstracts, everything that we've done. There's also published reports on, especially like for the big grants, you always have to have like an end of term report or an end end of project report. Like what did you do? How much did you get accomplished? Yeah. What went wrong type of thing? Mm-hmm. And I think those systems work for sure. It's just that I think the volume now of what is out there and how much of it gets actually reviewed and re-reviewed and reflected on is probably not keeping pace with the with what like how fast research needs to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is true. Would you guys like to listen to one of Zaid's fantastic songs?
Yes.
Sure. Yes, music.
Yes, fantastic. So now we're playing Making Sense by Lil Silva.
Guess you just call it a phase, baby. Call it a way that you've been gone through. Got all these signs here from everyone. From everyone that's there. Just call it a phase. Call it a lifestyle. Say that you're still be moving on your own. Call it a come on now, cause you'll see it won't be.
Hello, you are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. This is STEMinism. It is currently Friday, March 15th, 5:38 p.m. And once again, I would like to remind you that if you're feeling up to it, please donate to CKUT at ckut.ca/donate. There's some really fun prizes. Depending on how much you donate, you can be entered to win some great prizes or a lemon pound cake that I will make you personally. CKUT means a lot to us. We're really happy to be here, so anything that you are willing to donate would really help us out and help keep us afloat. Thank you.
Amazing. So I actually got a new piece of information that slid my way while we were listening to that song. Mm-hmm. And apparently they do have community members. Shout out to Connor for telling me that. But basically the facilities for animal care, and basically these are the committees that regulate animal research in all the different institutions. So they do have a member of the community who is a non-scientist who is present and is able to kind of like approve also the protocols and validate the protocol. So I think that's pretty cool. That's one way that we can engage the public in science discourse. Yeah.
Cool.
Can't imagine how difficult it must be for them to actually follow the science and like read through all of these boring grants. Like I had to read through one grant of my supervisor and I was like, that's long.
They tell you to make it catchy, but like, it's never really that catchy. It's all sciencey lingo and
all the jargon.
So, we are very interested. So, you're doing both an MD and a PhD. And see, that's crazy because everyone that I've heard who's in just in med school alone is like really struggling. And then a PhD alone, I know personally, it's quite a struggle. Yeah. And you're doing both over the course of 8 years. So how is my question? I don't even know how to ask you a longer question because how is kind of like the essence of it all.
So you asked me when you started this is like, what's your schedule like? And I tried to like evade it a little bit. honestly, like it's a lot of, I will say, okay, I need to start this by just saying that, like, to survive it, you have to be mindful. Like, mindful of yourself first, and then mindful of your limits second. And then, because it's nonstop, really. Like, the difference between, like, an MD-PhD student, other than the years, and an MD student, is just that you have to recognize that, you know, the cohort you start with in med school, for instance, like my cohort is graduating this year. Like they're going to go into residency and whatnot. And in 4 years, they're like up there in residency. So I'm technically being interviewed by them for like the same when we started at the same point. But you know what I mean? So you have to recognize that like time for you isn't necessarily time for others. And that's okay. That's your path. You like, if that's what you believe in, then that's what you should pursue. Mm-hmm. But also recognize that like the skills that you gain as an MD PhD are also different from just an MD student. So a lot of MDs, for example, in training, at medical school or whatnot, oftentimes will tell you that when it comes to sometimes research, they might not feel as confident, or they might not feel that like they can read it very well, they can understand it and decipher the results very well, but perhaps they're not as familiar with the methods or like what goes into like, you know, making a paper or like all that like hard work that the science people are very expert in, but not necessarily know from the medicine side of things. So MD-PhD is really trying to like bridge that gap, like trying to be at the center of both science and medicine, and what we like to say is like patient and bedside. Mm-hmm. Patient and benchside. So every day, you know, my days start typically around 6 a.m., something like that. And then you go into check emails, check your schedules, see what's there for the day, like what's planned ahead. And then in the PhD, it's fairly simple. Go to lab, deal with the lab stuff, and then after lab you have like your extracurriculars or whatnot. In med school, it's a lot of like rotations, classes, mm-hmm. things like that academically. And the nice thing about it is like it's long because they have to be separate. Otherwise, I can't imagine myself doing both at the exact same time. There's literally no time. There's not even enough time to do a PhD on its own, so I can't even imagine doing a whole med school degree on top of that. Yeah. And so that's why I said like it's being mindful of yourself. You got to know that like you have to recognize that there is pressure and it's like it's always there. But like, okay, so how do I feel about that? Like, is this a good time for me? Is this not a good time for me? And if it is a good time for me, then, you know, I'm ready and I'll tackle that huge to-do list. And if it's not a good time, then maybe I can do something else and, like, bring myself up to sort of that, like, mental state where I'm mm-hmm. like, okay, let's get it all done and whatnot. And, you know, I don't know about other people's schedules, probably busier than mine, but, like, even mine is, like, it has enough flexibility that I can, like, take a moment and just like be like, okay, I'm here, I'm in this, I'm in the path that I love, so let me do it. I think it's also a bit of like recognizing the identities or roles that you have to fulfill. Like you guys are women in science, so you probably know more about this than I do, where it's like you have to fulfill sort of multiple roles at once to get it all done and get it all done efficiently, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. As a neuroscientist, especially, I feel like you have to wear so many different hats. Like you have to be both a surgeon and an engineer and a mathematician and an avid programmer and also really good designer. So you can, I don't know, design cues for the animals that you're experimenting. Like you have to do a lot of, you have to wear a lot of different hats, and that's just within the experimental scheme. And then you have a lot of other hats that you have to wear. You have to be a good communicator, a good author, a good
writer.
Exactly. Yeah. You have to be many different things at the same time. And sometimes you prioritize one over the other, but you can't do that for too long because then it kind of bites you and you need to step up your game. So it's kind of like juggling. Mm-hmm. You have to decide how long you can leave one thing up in the air, but at some point you have to catch it or else everything kind of falters. I feel like that's how I would describe it.
Yeah.
I saw this meme the other day, or it was like what you expect you're going to learn in your PhD, and it was a full circle of you're going to become an expert in this one field, and then what it's actually like doing your PhD, and like the circle is filled with 10 different things of like what you just said.
Random
communicating
things.
Writing reading, I don't know. All these things.
I still haven't learned how to read, so
honestly.
I'll get to that eventually.
If anyone knows how to read, please send help to ckut.ca.
That's why they're listening to our show and not like reading off
non-existent
blog posts, I guess.
Yeah, ckut.ca/donate, guys. Don't forget.
Help us improve our literacy rates.
Exactly.
So, do you find that you fit into, like, do you find that you fit in socially better with the med students or with, like, PhD students? Is there a big difference in terms of, like, personality for both kinds of groups?
Yes, at least from my experience, there is. But the nice thing is that their commonalities are so, like, they're so apparent that their differences don't really, like, stand out too much. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a difference in like in medicine, it's very high paced. Like, you know, you consult a patient, you see the patient, you have to write the consult. It's very like everything is almost immediate. In research, that's not necessarily the case. Like there's no immediate gain to most of what we do. It's a lot of waiting. It's a lot of reanalyzing, redoing, reissue until you eventually reach a stage where you're like, okay, this is good enough.
Yeah. You can't reevaluate. You can't call the patient 2 days later and you're like, actually, I think I changed my mind.
Exactly.
Let me open you up.
Exactly. It's not like patients can get a refund.
You can't be like, actually, can I take it back? Like that medicine that you took, can you give it back to me? I don't think I like that decision. You can't do that.
Actually, when I was 12, I broke my arm and she was like, no, it's not broken. I did an x-ray and everything. And then 2 days later, she was like, I was wrong. Your arm's broken.
Wait, so she saw the x-ray, determined it was not broken, and then was she like looking at it again with her morning paper and was like, wait a minute.
I don't know, I still have so many questions as well. I have no idea what was going on there.
Wow, I am so sorry.
Or maybe it got sent to someone else. I don't really, I don't know what happened.
It's just what doctors do for fun. Like, they don't read the newspaper in the morning. They look at their patients' scans and whatnot.
For a lot of doctors, it is. Because, like, they can't get through the volume of, like, how much work there is. But, yes, so a lot of, like, I think a lot of those differences between the my different colleagues is just that. It's the light, like, the lifestyle that they have to, like, live. But I think in both worlds, and what's nice about it, and like why I enjoy all of this is because in both worlds, people are highly motivated. Like, they each have their own, like, mechanisms of, I'd like to call it survival, but it's more than that. It's just like, how do you deal with troubleshoot issues, and how do you, like, keep yourself on top of things and maintain your mental health? Mm-hmm. Like, med students, a lot of med students will take time off, or, like, you know, like, or we'll, like, sit together and be like, hey, so how was your day, or how, like, how did that go, and things like that, because they're in such high stress environments that they need to carve out sort of that space for themselves. Mm-hmm. With PhD students, it's a little different. It's milder. It's like, hey, can we get a coffee? Yeah, I have time before, like, you know, my meeting or something like that. And it's like, it's that congeniality of, like, trying to make it work in both fields that, like, gets it going.
Nice. And you're now in the med portion.
No, I'm the third year of the PhD.
Oh, so you're starting with the PhD and then you're doing the med portion?
At McGill, it's actually you do the first year and a half of the medical school.
Uh-huh.
And then you do the 4 years of the PhD.
Oh.
And then you go back to finish the last, like, 2.5 years of medical school.
Wow. That's
You basically finish your lecture style material in the first year and a half.
Okay.
Yeah. And then once you get into hospitals, that's where you sort of leave, come back.
That makes sense.
And McGill is actually unique in this because, like, it's the only program that also has, like, the transition to clerkship period, which is the second half of your second year is basically this period of 6 months where they get you ready that you're going to go and start clerkship. So it's the perfect time to go before to do your PhD, come back, then you, like, that transition to clerk, that 6 months is great for revision, getting you sorted, getting you settled, and, like, you're back in med school, let's go.
Oh, wow.
Kind of buckling up again.
Yeah. It's really good that they do that. I haven't heard of these kind of transition periods for, like, MD-PhD programs abroad and, like, other places.
Yeah, McGill is, like, unique in its program, and it's really well made.
I feel like other schools should mimic that. Especially if you think it's working.
Yeah. I mean, so each school has its own sort of take on it, and different, like, MD-PhDs, unfortunately, have been, like, on the decline. Not on the decline, but I would say they, like, in terms of governmental support, have not been very well supported.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the programs, ever since they cut, like, CIHR funding a while ago. Most of the programs had to find funding for themselves or take it out of the university or, like, the medical faculty. And it's a big chunk of change.
Of course.
So, you know, it's not they're not easy also programs to sustain because these are students that have to still be paid stipends and whatnot and, you know, to compensate for, like, the time and the years that they spend. But MD-PhDs, as COVID has taught us, are a very important resource because, you know, once the pandemic happened and whatnot, we had a shortage of people who were able to efficiently translate the research to the medicine.
Absolutely.
And get the word out.
Yeah.
Also, because we have been talking about how long the MD-PhD takes, I just wanted to mention that some PhD students actually take, like, 7 to 8 years to
mine
finish just
like
the PhD.
Yep.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
You know, it could be worse, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is that, like, with all these, like, long periods like of study and whatnot, is at the end of it, for the most part, you're producing somebody who will have a significant impact wherever else they go.
Mm-hmm.
Like, a lot of the PhDs that spend, like, you know, 7-8 years or whatnot, like, we, like, at least for me, I look at them and I'm like, oh my god, like, the amount of knowledge that they just accrued in those additional years is you can't even think about it. Like, you can't even quantify it. So it's like, you know, it's tough, and it's all, like, it's not always very rewarding to, like, day to day, but in the end, I
feel
like.
In the end, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's always about how you make it. Actually, we have a minute and a half left, so perhaps if you have anything that you would like to say, 2 minutes and a half, anything that you would like to say for the audience, from the perspective of your MD PhD journey, or, and the audience being either like the people listening or specifically the scientific audience, if you have any cool insights.
I'll talk in general. I will just say that, like, it's okay. There's all
that was so comforting. I want to cry.
It'll be better. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it.
Literally cured my entire anxiety in one sentence.
Thank you. Thank you. Listen, I'll use that as a reference in my med school application.
Absolutely. Yeah.
They'll listen to the show and they'll, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And thank you so much to my parents and my friends and family for, like, all their support and, like, literally standing by me through all this journey, because it is a crazy ride. So, yeah, that's all I had.
That's very sweet.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I guess we would love to end at another one of your favorite songs. Yes. Yeah, so do you...
We do have a couple ads we have to play first, though. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But you should still introduce the song.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm very much voting for Lovesick Doctor.
Okay. Then we are playing Lovesick Doctor right now by Thunder Jackson.
Yeah. So.
But the ads go first.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. but really quickly, you've been listening to Steminism. It is currently March 15th, Friday, 5:54 p.m. Thank you so much for joining us. And please go to ckut.ca/donate. We appreciate you.
If it sounds like Montreal, it sounds like CKUT. CKUT's annual funding drive is back, and this year we're celebrating the city that made us. From Friday, March 15th to Sunday, March 24th, tune in for an earful of Montreal-made magic. Your favorite programmers will be live in studio and live streaming online for the first time ever. Tune in online, on the good old-fashioned radio, or join us in person. CKUT friends and family will be providing the tunes for an opening party at Bar La Marche à Côté on March 14th and a closing night on March 23rd at Nouvel Établissement. Stay tuned at our website for other events that put the fun in fundraising. Don't miss these celebrations of community radio and sounds of the city from your favorite local DJs. We need $50,000 to keep CKUT on the map. Powering a nonprofit radio station is more expensive than ever. Will you answer the call of your community before it's too late? Donate now by visiting ckut.ca/donate or by calling 514-907-9424. CKUT 90.3 FM, the sound of Montreal since 1987.
talking about, man? Yeah, transcendence.
Bonsoir tout le monde, vous êtes sur les ondes de CKUT, nous sommes vendredi le 15 mars et c'est Alex qui vous parle en direct des studios de CKUT pour votre émission d'art et de culture du vendredi.